The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the edition dated July 6th through July 13th, 2012. And as you may know if you're a regular listener, that occasionally during holiday periods they'll print only one magazine for the two-week period. And such is the case for this week. So we'll be using some material that I have pulled from the Week magazine online, as well as some special articles that we don't normally have a chance to cover in the hour. So I hope you enjoy today's program. Be just a little bit different. Our first article today, will a GOP-backed voter ID law turn Pennsylvania red? It's been 24 years since the Keystone State picked a GOP presidential candidate, but a move to bar voters who lack a driver's license could help Mitt Romney reverse that trend. Civil rights groups are fuming in Pennsylvania, where hundreds of thousands of registered voters without photo IDs won't be able to cast ballots in November unless they get new state-recognized ID cards. The reason? A new law designed to combat voter fraud that the Republican-controlled legislature pushed through. During debate over the bill, a GOP official said that 99% of Pennsylvania's voters would be unaffected by this ID requirement, but new figures indicate that 9.2% of potential voters, at some 760,000 people, lack suitable ID. Democrats argue that left-leaning voters, the poor, elderly, and minorities, will be disproportionately affected. Pennsylvania hasn't chosen the GOP candidate in a presidential election since George H.W. Bush's 1988 victory. But one Republican lawmaker recently boasted that the new voter ID law could push the state into the win column for Mitt Romney. Is this a game changer? Well, this law really could turn a blue state red. The Pennsylvania GOP's power grab could change the outcome of the 2012 election, says Steve Bannon at MSNBC. If I had to guess, I'd say a very high majority of the affected voters are either poor, students, minorities, or some combination therein. In other words, they're likely Democratic voters. In a tight election, barring hundreds of thousands of those voters from the polls could tip the race from President Obama to Romney, which is why Republicans approved it in the first place. But it should be easy for Democratic voters to comply. Really, people, how hard is it to get an ID? Asked James Joyner, an Outside the Beltway. These people have already managed to register to vote, so they ought to be able to get an identification card, something they'd need to see an R-rated movie. Surely it's not unreasonable to ask them to show one to ensure our elections are above board. On the other hand, no one has proved that voter fraud is a real problem, and until that happens, it really is wrong to disenfranchise anybody over this. This is undemocratic no matter how it plays out. Even if Pennsylvania's voter ID law were honest legislation, it would be honestly bad legislation, says the Citizen's Voice. The naked truth is that the law wasn't designed to prevent fraud, but rather to suppress Democratic votes, as State Representative Mike Terzai, the GOP's majority leader, awkwardly admitted when he said this could allow Romney to win a state he'd lose in a fair fight. Whether it works or not, this law is an affront to democracy. Now, in a related article on the campaign trail here, video stalking on the campaign trail. Have Democrats gone too far? Some GOP candidates complain that rivals are invading their privacy by shooting video of their luxury homes and posting it online to turn voters against them. Videographers known as campaign trackers, a fixture in modern politics, follow their candidates' rivals to document every public appearance on tape. But some Democratic trackers are crossing the line between public and private this year, Politico reports. Shooting video of the homes of wealthy GOP congressmen and candidates and posting the footage online, to Republicans' dismay. It's totally inappropriate, said Representative Reed Ribble, a Republican from Wisconsin, after a 38-second clip of his generously proportioned home showed up on the web. For their part, Democratic officials say videotaping Republican candidates' mansions to show they can't relate to struggling families is perfectly legitimate. Invasion of privacy or just political hardball? That's the question. This is simply creepy. Following candidates around is part of the game, says Mo Lane at Red State, and even that, waiting for hours in the hope your opponent will say something career-ending, is kind of obsessive and sad. This, however, is unquestionably an invasion of privacy. Representative Jim Renacci, a Republican from Ohio, told Politico that his neighbor caught a tracker hiding in his bushes. Sorry, but that's out-and-out stalking. GOP mansions are fair game, says one political commentator. House Republicans have spent this entire Congress trying to hide that they're protecting benefits for millionaires and perks for themselves. Jesse Ferguson, a spokesman for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, tells Politico, Democrats are under no obligation to let them keep it secret any longer. This is a perfectly legitimate way to show that these GOP candidates look out for themselves instead of the middle class. This is not helping the Democrats' cause. The video of Renacci's house looks like it was shot by some deranged ex-husband, says Dan Amira at New York. The only thing missing? Heavy mouth breathing. The really odd thing is that the DCCC says posting the clips online allows outside groups to use them in commercials without violating laws. So it's both creepy and undermining campaign finance laws. Now from politics, we'll turn to some other more recent news within the past week, as we have found on the online edition of the Week magazine. Our first item is from Pennsylvania. City workers in Scranton, Pennsylvania, had to be surprised on Friday when their wages dropped to just $7.25 an hour, the state's minimum wage. But Mayor Chris Doherty says that all Scranton can afford. I'm trying to do the best I can with the limited amount of funds that I have, he tells NPR. Our people work hard, our police and fire. I just don't have enough money, and I can't print it in the basement. Scranton's financial woes date back to World War II, when the city population began dropping. But now officials are clashing over a $16.8 million budget gap. Doherty, who cut his own pay to $7.25 an hour, too, wants to raise taxes while city councilors want to borrow the money. Meanwhile, city coffers dropped to just $5,000 after the last paychecks went out, and unions are planning to fight the wage decrease in court tomorrow. Don't know how I'm going to pay bills at home, said one firefighter. I may be able to stave it off for a little while. The next item from the news of this past week in the Week magazine, it might be a while before Walter Zultz, Jr. decides it's safe to go back in the water. He was kayaking for the first time in a Cape Cod beach on the weekend when he saw the fin of a great white shark longer than his kayak, just 10 feet behind him, and he started paddling furiously to get to shore, the New York Daily News says. Beachgoers had spotted the 12 to 14 foot shark long before Zultz did, but he couldn't hear their warnings at first. There were hundreds of people on the beach, and they were all at the edge, yelling, paddle, 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 one beachgoer says. Zultz says that before going in the water, he had assured his daughter that the odds of a shark encounter were very low. I found the odds, and they're not exactly as good as I thought, he said. Some Cape Cod beaches banned swimming last week after sightings of at least two great white sharks who have been attracted to the area by large numbers of gray seals. Two stats of note to drive home: just how hot it has been and continues to be in our area in North Carolina and most of the United States. Drought conditions now exist in 56% of the continental U.S., the biggest percentage in the 12 years that records have been kept by the weekly Drought Monitor, reports MSNBC. The heat already is taking a toll on crops. Across the U.S., more than 3,000 temperature records were broken from June 28 through yesterday, according to AccuWeather.com. They include record highs and maximum lows. One example, St. Louis high of 105 degrees on July 4th. And, of course, as you know, if you're listening in North Carolina, we have hit record highs in Raleigh and Fayetteville and a number of other cities around our state as well. The next item, Florida is in the midst of the worst tuberculosis outbreak the CDC has seen in two decades. And the Jacksonville outbreak was largely hidden from the public, finds the Palm Beach Post in a disturbing report. The outbreak apparently originated in 2008 when a schizophrenic patient came down with TB but was not treated and spread it to at least 17 others over a period of 8 months, two of whom died. Then in 2011, there was a spike in that same rare strain, eventually prompting the Duval County Health Department to ask the CDC for help this year. The public was not alerted, nor was it alerted in 2008, and the county health director now acknowledges that was a mistake. He thought after 2008 that we had it contained. He says it was not contained. The CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, by the way, was brought in and revealed just how bad the outbreak was in an April report. By then, the strain of tuberculosis had been linked to 13 deaths and 99 cases, and as many as 3,000 people could have been exposed. But the report was never seen by key decision makers in Florida, and the public was not informed until June, by which point the strain had reached other parts of the state. Meanwhile, an important hospital for treating tuberculosis was closed, and the state is having a difficult time treating the outbreak since it has spread mainly in homeless communities and other dorm living situations. Now, just 253 of the people possibly exposed to TB have been located, and there are indications the strain has moved into the general population. Now let's take a look at some of the best columns in business news around the United States for this past week. Our first column is Beggaring the Young for the Old, and it's written by David Frum in thedailybeast.com. We had better learn to say no to the elderly, said David Frum, or we'll end up loading insurmountable pain and suffering upon the young. Today, almost a third of 18 to 29-year-olds are either jobless or working part-time. This early career vacuum will devastate many of them for life, translating into lower earning power, delayed marriages and parenthood, and higher debt. And it means that most of today's 20-somethings may well fail to attain the living standards of their parents. Yet because American seniors unabashedly vote their interests as a demographic group, the country will almost certainly keep offloading the immense costs of our pay-it-forward economics onto this already beleaguered younger generation. Our politicians refuse to jumpstart the economy with a massive jolt of fiscal stimulus because that might risk inflation and pose a threat to retirement savings. They won't create jobs with infrastructure projects because older Americans oppose taxes. I know it's the nation's duty to care for the needs of seniors, but it's uncaring for society to neglect the old. It's outright suicidal to cannibalize the life chances of the rising generation. Our next column is entitled The Old Paths to Growth Are Gone by Robert Samuelson in The Washington Post. We live in a world of broken economic models, said Robert Samuelson. The conventional routes the U.S., Europe, and China used to achieve economic success no longer apply. The vaunted American model of consumer-led growth is now ancient history. Household net worth fell 39% between 2007 and 2010, so the economy can no longer rely on Americans' lavish borrowing and spending to deliver growth. The problem is that there is no clear sense of what might replace consumer spending as the engine of the global economy. We can't export our way to expansion because weak economies abroad lack demand. We can't turn to more government spending, as that would lead to even larger politically unpalatable deficits. Europe's traditional approach of fragile equilibrium between slow economic growth and expensive welfare states has completely unraveled, leaving a gnawing uncertainty about what may come next there. And even China's much-heralded export-led economic model is in danger. With our traditional models under assault on all fronts, we face a tortuous and possibly inconclusive economic stalemate ahead. And the next column is Clueless About the Euro's End by Simon Johnson in Bloomberg.com. Very few people on either side of the Atlantic seem to grasp the potentially catastrophic consequences for banks if the euro dissolves, said Simon Johnson. It all boils down to a basic uncertainty. If you have a contract that requires you to be paid in euros and the euro no longer exists, what you'll receive is unclear. Let's say you lent 1 million euros to a German bank. Then the euro dissolves and you are offered payment in Deutschmarks. But what would the exchange rate be? What would happen if you lent to a German bank's London branch or to a subsidiary in, say, the Cayman Islands? The legal and financial complexity would be mind-boggling. Litigation could drag on for years, and that's just the straightforward contracts. No one really knows what the implications would be for the dizzying world of derivatives. But crippling losses for major U.S. banks seems likely. After all, if a bank like J.P. Morgan can lose $3 billion in a relatively calm quarter through incompetence and neglect, how much might it lose when markets really turn nasty? Now we'll take a look at some business items from The Week magazine for this week. It's a special holiday edition of The Week magazine. The first article is about Congress actively trading while legislating. Some 130 congressmen or their families traded stocks in companies that were lobbying on bills before the lawmakers' committees between 2007 and 2010, said Dan Keating, David Fallis, Kimberly Kendi, and Scott Higman, in an article in the Washington Post. An analysis of congressional stock transactions shows that 34 members of Congress also recast their financial portfolios during the financial crisis after secret meetings with top officials. The analysis does not provide evidence of insider trading, but it shows that lawmakers routinely make trades that raise questions about potential conflicts. The next article is about the Internet. Google CEO's health questioned. There's speculation that 39-year-old Google CEO Larry Page may have a serious medical condition, says Amir Efradi and Johan Lublin in the Wall Street Journal. Page missed last week's annual stockholders meeting as well as Google's annual developers conference this week, absences that Google said were the result of Page having lost his voice. The company provided no other information about Page's condition, but in an email to employees, Page wrote that there is nothing seriously wrong with me and that he will continue to run the company. The next item from the tech area, Microsoft's big bet on social enterprise. Microsoft agreed to pay $1.2 billion this past week for Yammer, a kind of Facebook for the business world, said Richard Waters and April Dembosky in the Financial Times. Yammer allows businesses to create private social networks where employees can post announcements, share files, and swap messages. Some 5 million workers already use the service, including employees at 85% of Fortune 500 companies, and Microsoft hopes to integrate the social networking tool alongside its traditional business software. The Yammer deal is Microsoft's biggest acquisition since it purchased Skype last year for $8.5 billion. And the next article from the housing area, new homes selling faster. Sales of new homes increased 7.6% in May, a welcome sign that the housing market continues a steady, if slow, recovery, said Martin Krutzinger in the Associated Press. Sales jumped to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 369,000 homes, the fastest pace since April 2010, the last month of the federal home buying tax credit. However, even with the gains, the annual sales pace is only about half the 700,000 that economists consider to be healthy. Now, the issue of the week in the business section of the Week magazine is about JCPenney. It's called JCPenney's No Sales Misfire. These are turbulent times at JCPenney Company, said Ann Denzenzio in the Associated Press. The retailer's sales have plummeted since it introduced a new pricing strategy this year that all but banned the word sale. The approach is the brainchild of CEO Ron Johnson, a former Apple executive Penny recruited last year on the strength of his phenomenal success in creating the Apple Store. Johnson ordered Penny to cancel its hundreds of annual sales events in favor of a fair and square model that reduced prices by 40% and kept them there. But the strategy has backfired with customers, said James Covert in the New York Post. Last week, marketing chief Michael Francis, a former Target executive handpicked by Johnson, left abruptly after just 8 months on the job. The company let Francis be the fall guy, claiming his marketing blunders left customers confused. But analysts say Penny's ads aren't to blame. It's just that consumers want discounts. Penny's bold pricing plan is a reinvention of traditional retail, said Brad Tuttle in Time.com, and it asks a lot of shoppers. They tend to like playing games and hunting for deals, but Penny has pulled the sales equivalent of grabbing the ball and taking it home. The retailer claims that it has lowered prices, pointing out that a T-shirt that retailed for, say, $14 but wound up selling for $6 on sale is now $7 from the start. But where's the fun in that? After all, if a store's prices are going to remain the same tomorrow and next week and the month after that, there's not much incentive to browse the aisles for special deals today. Someone should remind Johnson that Penny isn't Apple, said Daniel Ferry at MotleyFool.com. The retailer has always been about bargain hunting, whereas Apple built customer devotion with status symbol products. In breaking with Penny's past, Johnson wastes an advantage that its brand does confer and counts on a branding power and loyalty that it doesn't possess, hasn't earned, and doesn't look likely to gain. Don't count Johnson out yet, said Laura Heller in Forbes.com. This is, after all, the man who worked at the feet of Steve Jobs, developing an operation that is the envy of every retailer on the planet. There are always doubters, but turnarounds take time. Johnson recently reintroduced the word sale and is striking partnerships with personalities like Martha Stewart. But most importantly, he is sticking to the plan, just like Jobs. The next is a series of articles called Making Money, What the Experts Have to Say About This. An interesting one. I think you'll like it. The first one is entitled, When Bias Costs Billions. Your fund manager may be too much of a homebody, said Ian Salisbury in SmartMoney.com, and it could be hurting your portfolio. Professional investment managers collect billions in fees to scour the market for bargains that ordinary investors would never find on their own. But a recent study from Indiana University's Kelley School of Business suggests that portfolio managers overweight companies based in the state where they grew up by 12% on average. Given the size of the mutual fund industry, this hometown bias accounts for about $31 billion in investments each year. The bias appears to be stronger with younger investment managers, suggesting the quirk may be tied to experience. And it poses a risk to your portfolio, since companies in the same state tend to be affected by similar business trends. You could be too concentrated in one area of the economy, said study co-author Scott Yonker. The next item, tax credits for summer camp. With summer here, parents will be pleased to hear that they can get a tax credit or use money in a flexible spending account for their kids' day camp, said Kimberly Langford in Kiplinger.com. If your child is younger than 13 and you send him to day camp while both you and your spouse work or look for work, you can use your flexible spending account for costs. The key is that only summer day camp counts, not overnight camp. The criteria are the same for the child care tax credit. Families can count up to $3,000 in expenses for one child or up to $6,000 for two or more children. But you have to choose. You can't use the flexible spending account and the tax credit for the same expenses. And the next article is entitled Airing Credit Card Complaints. Want to know how your credit card company treats its customers? Asked Ruth Simon in WSJ.com. It's now easier to find out. Last week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unveiled a searchable credit card complaint database available at consumerfinance.gov/complaint database. So far, the database includes only complaints back to June 1. But the Bureau says it will add the roughly 17,000 additional complaints it has received since last July over the next few months. Consumers can sort results by company name and type of complaint, as well as by whether a case closed with an explanation or monetary relief. Billing disputes and gripes about interest rates are currently the top grievances. Now from news, we're going to turn to the art section of the Week magazine, something that we normally do not have time for. And one of the sections that I personally always enjoy, and I think you might as well, is the section about books. As you may know, before I get into reading this here, the Triangle Radio Reading Service earlier this year produced a special program about the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's a half-hour program called So All May Read, and it talks about the different resources of the North Carolina Library for the Blind. This program, by the way, if you haven't heard it yet, is available online by going on to TriangleReadingService.org. Or if you'd like to hear it right here live on the Triangle Radio Reading Service, it will be carried next week on Tuesday, July 17th at 8:30 p.m. And it will be rebroadcast the next day, the 18th, at 1:30 in the afternoon. That's So All May Read. And I want to mention to you as well that if you are not a user of the services of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, you're missing a real treat here if you are blind or visually impaired. All you have to do is become a patron. It's absolutely free to do that. And once you do, you have the opportunity to access an enormous library of talking books that are delivered now digitally, and you receive a digital talking player, extremely easy to use. Even if you are blind or visually impaired, it's very, very easy to use. There are many, many books to choose from, and I know that you would enjoy it. I'm going to give you the phone number right now, and then after we talk about some of the books in the Week magazine this week, I'll repeat that number for you in case you'd like to make a note of it. It's a toll-free number. If you'd like to call and ask about how to become a patron, you can call 1-888-388-2460, or if you are in the Triangle area, you can call 919-733-4376. And again, I'll repeat those numbers after we talk about some of these books. But the North Carolina Library is a wonderful resource, and if you're not a patron already, I encourage you to take a look at it. It is absolutely free, doesn't cost you anything to send the books back. They mail them to you for free, and you send them back for free. And They also have a huge collection of large print books as well, over 25,000 large print books, really more than you could find in any of the local libraries. So you might want to check that out. But now, to get back to business here, let's read from the art section, the review of books. This week, for July 6th through the 13th, summer fiction, five novels, almost too good for the beach, they say. The first one is entitled Gone Girl, and it's by Gillian Flynn. Marriage is murder in Gillian Flynn's brilliant black comic, third novel, said Laura Miller in Salon.com, one of a handful of contemporary thriller writers who are kicking the genre into a higher gear. Flynn constructs her latest crime dazzler atop a mercilessly observant portrait of contemporary romance, one that might have been written by Jonathan Franzen or Jeffrey Eugenides. Eugenides. Amy and Nick Dunn are enduring an uncomfortable fifth anniversary when we meet them, and soon they'll each explain in alternating accounts how they plummeted so quickly from a charmed New York life to a bitter marital standoff in a rented house in North Carthage, Missouri. But first, patrician Amy will disappear amid signs of a struggle, and tabloid coverage will make her handsome, self-satisfying husband the prime suspect. Flynn, a former Entertainment Weekly writer, has the enviable ability to mix pop culture savvy with the atmospherics and themes of classic literature, said Andrea Simakis in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Think the Bronte sisters on staff at TMZ. She has Amy's side of the story reach us through a diary, and that voice, possibly from beyond the grave, helps turn Gone Girl into an ingenious whodunit for both the Facebook generation and old-school mystery buffs. For every reader, it will linger like fingerprints on a gun. And that is Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. The next one is entitled The Age of Miracles by Karen Thompson Walker. Here's a second title that's destined to become one of this summer's hot literary reads, said Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times. Karen Thompson Walker won a seven-figure advance for this debut, then earned it by turning an intriguing sci-fi concept into a genuinely moving tale that cleverly mixes the real and the surreal. In the near future, the rotation of the Earth mysteriously begins to slow, causing days and nights to become longer, crops to fail, birds to fall from the sky, and apocalyptic worries to mount. Hollywood-ready contrivances occasionally intrude on the spell the author creates, but what sets the story apart from more run-of-the-mill high-concept novels is Walker's decision to recount the unfolding catastrophe from the perspective of Julia, who is on the verge of turning 12 years old. It's a brilliant stroke, said Melissa Mayers in Entertainment Weekly. While the planet faces dire consequences, Julia is consumed by such questions as how to talk to her crush and when to buy her first bra. The juxtaposition of the parallel running dramas perfectly captures what it's like to be a teenager, always feeling like the world is going to end, waiting for the day when life goes back to normal, until you grow up and discover that it never really does. Again, that's The Age of Miracles, and the author is Karen Thompson Walker. The next book is called The Red House by Mark Haddon. Think twice before you pack Mark Haddon's new novel for a lengthy getaway with relatives, said Ron Charles in The Washington Post. The latest from the author of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime just might be too knowing about the tensions and anxieties that attend vacations with extended family. Shortly after their mother's death, a doctor invites his estranged sister, as well as her husband and three children, to spend a week's vacation with his own family in a rented English farmhouse near the Welsh border. Obviously, there's something of a lifeboat drama about this setup. Eight wary strangers thrown together with a dangerously limited supply of affection, As each character begins unpacking emotional baggage, Haddon captures every knife twist and fresh wound by cutting constantly from one character's perspective to another's. While they may sound confusing, the voices are so distinct that once you can keep up, the effect is symphonic. By the time you finish reading, you might even consider the novel a spirit booster, said Carmela Chiaro in USA Today. Alongside all the arguments, deceptions, and hoarded resentments, Haddon has included an abundance of dark humor. Better yet, each character ends the week bearing a lighter load than they came with. It sounds like a good one. It's called The Red House by Mark Haddon. The next book is Mission to Paris by Alan First. Alan First's 12th novel is historical fiction in the best sense of both words, says Jeffrey Katz in NPR.org. As 1938 Europe moves inexorably toward war, an Austrian-born Hollywood movie star arrives in Paris to shoot a film and quickly draws the attention of Nazi operatives who wish to enlist him in their efforts to manipulate the French. Though he initially resists, American spies coax him into acting as a double agent. First is a master at conjuring European scenes and moods during those fraught pre-war years, said Tom Nolan in the Wall Street Journal. Smoky Paris nightclubs, Art Deco ocean liners, and Moroccan back streets all come to life in technicolor detail. Besides, it's a treat to watch the decent, capable protagonist move between movie making and the cloak and dagger trade. Sounds like an interesting historical novel, Mission to Paris, it's called, by Alan First. And finally, the fifth book recommended for the beach, and again, the title of this was Five Novels Almost Too Good for the Beach, and they sound like they might be that. This one is called Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. Jess Walter's sixth novel possesses pathos, piercing wit, and most important, the soul of a literary classic, said Steve Almond in the Boston Globe. This audacious work spins many stories out of the filming of Cleopatra, the 1963 epic starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Scene one lights up the moment that Pasquale Tursi, proprietor of the Hotel Adequate View, lays eyes on Dee Moray, a Hollywood star who is unexpectedly checking in to his modest pension. Dee turns out to be pregnant with Burton's child, and when she departs, leaves Pasquale harboring a 50-year crush. Beautiful Ruins might remind readers of two of the best novels to come out in recent years, Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad and Colm McCann's Let the World Spin, said Kevin Canfield in the Kansas City Star. Walter is that good. As the author juggles several storylines, he builds toward an ending that is a 12-page bolt of brilliance. And in addition to those five good beach reads that are recommended by The Week magazine, there is each week a book list that is compiled by a famous author, and this week the best books recommended by were chosen by Dave Eggers, the author of Zaytoon, and What is the What describes the books that inspired him as he wrote his new novel, A Hologram for the King, and that one's about a U.S. businessman looking for life's answers while waiting to meet the king of Saudi Arabia. And this is just a brief description of each one of these books that are recommended by David Eggers, and some of them are quite old, have been around for a long time, so there are only six of them. Let me give you a brief description of each one. The first one is entitled Dangling Man by Saul Bellow. Bellow explores the psyche of a young man waiting to hear if he's been drafted. I don't know if anyone's ever better represented the workings of the mind in crisis or the mental state of a human whose life might change permanently based on forces far beyond his control. Dangling Man by Saul Bellow. The next one recommended by Eggers is The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles. Every time I read this book, I love it more. Terrible things happen to its characters, three young Americans traveling through Morocco, but Bowles' writing is so hypnotic that the calamities are seen through a certain anodyne haze. And despite its darkness, it's the most humane of existential novels. Again, that one's called The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles. David Eggers goes on here to recommend The Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, a great old novel. I've only seen the play performed once a long time ago, Eggers said, but a few years ago I reread the text and was astounded by how funny it is on the page. I know it's considered pretty dour by many, but the play is so nimble and knowing. There's a satirical topspin that there's not often is acknowledged, and that's Death of a Salesman, which you may have read before, but you might be able to get that, probably could get that, on a digital talking book from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The next one recommended by Eggers is Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre. And this was written in 1938. This novel still feels electric. It's about a young man disgusted by the futility of his existence, but reading the book is strangely invigorating. Great art as a near-religious experience. That's Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre. The next one recommended is Something Happened by Joseph Heller. Here is an American businessman, Bob Slocum, looks back and forward on a life that seems devoid of meaning. A soldier in World War II, he now finds himself in an office where virtually nothing happens. So he fought as a young man for the right to do nothing the rest of his life, which raises the question, what's more absurd, war or antiseptic drudgery of many workplaces? Something Happened by Joseph Heller. And finally, the last one recommended by author Dave Eggers is Selected Writings of the American Transcendentalists by George Hochfield. This is a fantastic collection, according to Eggers. Anyone wanting to understand the American DNA then and now must read The Transcendentalists. Pious, bold, passionate, obstinate, naive, and capable of breathtaking acts of beauty. Again, that's called The Selected Writings of the American Transcendentalists by George Hochfield. I don't know that all of these books are available, but I suspect most of them are from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and they are just a phone call or an online message away if you are a patron. If you're not already a patron, you can become a patron absolutely free by calling toll-free 1-888-388-2460. I'll repeat that, 888-388-2460. Or you can call 919-733-4376. Tell them that you heard about the services of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and that you would like to become a patron, and they will do anything they can to help you. Again, I mentioned we have a special program called So All May Read about the North Carolina Library for the Blind, and it airs every month. It will be heard next week on Tuesday, July 17th at 8:30 p.m., and it will be rebroadcast on Wednesday, July 18th at 1:30 in the afternoon. You can also listen online by going to trianglereadingservice.org, and I hope you will take advantage of that. It is a wonderful service, and if you are blind or visually impaired, then I think you will definitely enjoy being a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind. And you're listening to a special edition of The Week magazine this week on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, there's only one magazine published for July 6th and the 13th, so we were able to pull out some additional articles here from online, and I hope you enjoy it. It's a little different from the normal format that we follow on this program. This is an article from MarketWatch that I think you will find interesting. Dateline Washington, looking around in your neighborhood and around the world, you might get the idea that everyone is suffering from our hard times. Millions of people are out of work. Millions of homes are threatened with foreclosure. Students are in hock up to their necks. Retirees are getting nothing on their bank accounts. State and local governments are cutting back services and employment. The federal government's debt is soaring. Small businesses can't get loans to expand or to stock their shelves. But corporations are swimming in cash while we are drowning. Market Watch's Rex Nutting has a bone to pick with U.S. corporations who are swimming in cash but not investing in the future. And he brings his anger to Main Street, which is a column from Reuters. Although all those things are happening, not everyone is suffering equally. In fact, some people are doing fine, and those people are corporations. President Barack Obama got a lot of grief last month when he said the private sector is doing fine. As a political statement, it was about as tone-deaf as they come. But as a piece of economic analysis, the president was spot on. The private sector is doing fine, especially the larger companies. Private sector businesses, large and small, have increased their employment by 3.2 million since the recession officially ended 3 years ago. Over the past year, private employment has increased 1.8%, about twice as fast as the population is growing. On the hiring side, the private sector is doing fine, not great. We may judge the private sector on its contribution to job growth, but there's only one standard by which businesses measure their success, and that is profits. And by that standard, U.S. corporations are doing better than ever. Corporations are currently swimming in profits. The return on investment for corporations has surged to record levels. Unfortunately, their success means very little to the rest of us. It has boosted the stock market, but it hasn't led to a robust expansion of jobs or investment in America that could create more jobs in the future. After-tax profits of non-financial corporations soared to a record 11.4% of national income in 2011. In the 11 quarters since the recession officially ended, profits have averaged 10.8% of national income. From 1947 to 1999, that ratio was never above 9%. So if you're a corporation, these really are the best of times. The return on investment is also at a record high level. After-tax profits of non-financial corporations rose to a record 14.7% of the cost of tangible assets, double what it was during the 1980s, which was also a boom time. If you're a believer in supply-side economics, you know what's supposed to come next. A boom like never seen before. In theory, increasing the returns from investment should provide incentives to supply even more investments. But we know that did not happen. Instead of plowing their profits back into more productive assets like land, buildings, equipment, and intellectual property, corporations mostly gave $1.5 trillion they earned in profits in 2011 back to their shareholders through dividends and stock buybacks, or else hoarded it in a corporate rainy day fund. In 2011, corporations authorized about $450 billion in share repurchases and paid out the same amount in dividends. At the same time, non-financial corporations had $1.7 trillion in liquid assets on their books. Corporations are investing, but only a little. As a percentage of internally generated funds, capital spending has dropped to the lowest levels on record. It's not as if corporations haven't been investing at all. They have been, just not at the usual pace. Capital spending on fixed investments rose by about 11% in 2011 to $1 trillion, accounting for about half of the 1.7% growth in gross domestic product last year. The investment was significant, but it was still less than corporations had invested in 2006. And as a proportion of internal funds generated by corporations, investments in the U.S. are at record low levels. In most years since the 1940s, corporations' capital spending has exceeded their internal cash flow, meaning they were borrowing and raising capital from the outside to fund their investments. That's now been reversed. Corporations are not lenders, Corporations are net lenders, not borrowers. As usual, corporations returned more money to shareholders in 2011 than they raised from share offerings. Corporations aren't raising any money in the stock market either. In 2011, corporations returned about $473 billion to shareholders, mostly through buybacks, mergers, and acquisitions. The last year that corporations raised any net money by selling stock to the public was 1993. To a surprising extent, corporations are now in the business of returning capital to their owners, not in the business of raising money from savers in order to put those savings to best use, as described in Economics 101 textbooks. Corporations may be intensely profitable, but they have no profitable ideas about what to do with the vast sums they earn. The owners of corporations are getting rich, but they would do well to wonder where next year's profits or the next decade's profits are going to come from. Again, that article was written by Rex Nutting. He's a columnist and MarketWatch's international commentary editor who is based in Washington. And a couple of additional articles here as we move toward the end of the program. Yesterday's tepid job report firms up evidence that the recovery is backsliding and increasing the odds that the Federal Reserve will try to give it a jolt, reports the Wall Street Journal. The most likely move by Ben Bernanke would be to buy bonds or quantitative easing in econo-speak with the intent to drive down interest rates, spur investment, and move investors into stocks. The Journal provides a look into the Fed's activist and hawk camps, noting that Bernanke has tended to side with the activists of late, especially because hawks' fears of higher inflation haven't materialized. We may get the first hint of what, if anything, is to come when Bernanke testifies on Capitol Hill next week, July 17th and 18th. The Fed's next policy meeting comes soon after that at the end of the month. Now, an interesting article from the health section of the Week magazine. The best preventive health care for your baby may come in canine form. A study focused on respiratory tract infections like colds and ensuing ear infections found that Finnish infants who lived with dogs were healthy 73% of the time during their first 12 months. For kids without dogs, the figure was 65%, the Wall Street Journal reports. The kids who were healthy most often, 75.7% of the time, lived with dogs who spent at least 18 hours a day romping outdoors. That could be because those pups bring home more dirt and germs, which experts say can help boost a developing immune system. Babies with dogs also needed fewer antibiotics, a researcher says. Overall, kids in homes with dogs had about 30% lower risk of respiratory infection symptoms and about half the ear infection risk, the AFP notes. Cats, too, appeared to help babies' health, but the link was weaker. The study reviewed 397 kids born in the same hospital. Research was based on weekly parental polls, starting when the baby was 9 weeks old. But almost no one got off scot-free. Only 3% of babies did not have a runny nose at some point. And I hate to close on a sad note, but we'll do that with the mention of Ernest Borgnine, who is the hefty Hollywood actor who went from bad guy roles to Oscar stardom to TV comedy. He died this past week at the age of 95 in Los Angeles, according to the Associated Press. The former Navy serviceman started by playing villains in Hollywood movies, but avoided typecasting by snagging the Oscar-winning lead in Marty in 1955. "The Oscar made me a star, and I'm grateful," he said. "But I feel, had I not won the Oscar, I wouldn't have gotten into the messes I did in my personal life." Among those messes were four failed marriages for Ernest Borgnine, including a six-week union with singer Ethel Merman. But he succeeded in TV comedy, starring in McHale's Navy in the 1960s, and he kept acting in both movies and television. Recently, he actually played a voice role in SpongeBob SquarePants. He also found enduring matrimony with Norwegian-born Tove Trøisnes. But Borgnine complained in later years that roles were harder to come by. "I just want to do more work," he said. "Every time I step in front of a camera, I feel young again." Ernest Borgnine, dead at the age of 95. Another article from The Week for this week's edition. The Marines are moving toward the notion of putting more women in combat roles, and one Marine in particular, a woman, thinks it's a lousy idea. "As a combat-experienced Marine officer and a female, I am here to tell you that we are not all created equal," writes Captain Katie Petronio in the Marine Corps Gazette. She's worried that nowhere near enough study has been done on gender-specific medical issues, especially on the toll they may take on females in the long run, a view she holds based on firsthand experience in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Petronio also complains that it's well-meaning civilians who seem to be leading the push for the change without firsthand knowledge of the consequences. "This would be a huge change for the Marine Corps and a disastrous one," she argues. "For the long-term health of our female Marines, the Marine Corps, and U.S. national security, steer clear of the Marine infantry community when calling for more opportunities for females," writes Petronia. And we'll take a look at a couple of interesting quotes from Wit and Wisdom, which is another column in The Week magazine that we don't often have a chance to read because of time limitations. The first quote here is, "You don't want to be the best at what you do. You want to be the only one." Who said that? Jerry Garcia, quoted in the San Francisco Chronicle. The next quote, "Mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent," said Adam Smith, and he was quoted in humanevents.com. Next, "When a man realizes his littleness, his greatness can appear." I'll read that again. I didn't do it that well. "When a man realizes his littleness, his greatness can appear." And that was from H.G. Wells, quoted in Forbes.com. "And it is a very strange situation that the years teach us patience, that the shorter our time, the greater our capacity for waiting." That's from novelist Elizabeth Taylor, quoted in the Wall Street Journal. And finally, "Happy people do a great deal for their friends," said Willa Cather, and she was quoted in the Boston Globe. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.